Blog Talk Radio.
Y'all, welcome in. This is the V2V podcast where your stories are told, your voices are heard, and your hearts can begin to heal. My name is Dr. Marcy, America's Voice for the Voiceless, and I want to start off tonight, before I jump right into my intro, I would be remiss if I did not extend our prayers and our thoughts and our well wishes to the community of Uvalde, Texas. I'm sure by now everyone has heard the news. So our thoughts and our prayers are with the community. We are with the families of the 21 individuals who lost their lives today. And I think that the toll is still counting. So our thoughts and prayers go out to Uvalde, Texas. But we are going to go ahead and get into tonight's show. And just in case this is your first time tuning in, I do want to assure you that this is a safe space to bring your whole authentic self to. And each week when we get together, we discuss a variety of different critical life topics. And it's always transparent conversation. Sometimes it can get a little bit uncomfortable, but it's always my sincerest wish that something that you hear will help you grow through your discomfort. And tonight, as always, our intention is that something that you hear will touch you and empower you to make sustainable changes in your own life and relationships. And as always, I ask that God use us to have the conversation that you need to hear. I thank him for the voice, the platform, and the opportunity to become a conduit for healing. And tonight, we're going to be discussing what happens when you're forced to accept a diagnosis that you know is going to alter life as you know it. Specifically, we're going to be talking about a diagnosis of autism. My guest tonight is going to share his story and the story of his family and how they were able to cope with this experience. As a reminder, the phone lines are open all during the show, and we welcome your comments, your questions. That number, if you desire to call in, is 914-219-0880. And again, they'll be open for the duration of the show. The number is 914-219-0880. And for those of you who have been following V2V for the time that we have been on air, you've heard me probably several times mention how grateful I am for the many connections that I have that have come directly from social online engagement. And tonight's guest is most definitely one such friendship. From as far back as I can remember, I don't know how we ever got initially connected, but he's always been a tremendous supporter and cheerleader for me. And what he probably doesn't even know is he's also a source of inspiration for me as well. So let me introduce my good friend, known online by his social media moniker as The Guru, and his aim is to help as many people as possible develop common sense, which he shares stems from, in large part, him not using much common sense during the course of his lifetime, while growing up anyway. I think he's grown through that now. He's also the host of the Knucklehead Chronicles. He's also the host of the Knucklehead Chronicles podcast, which is a storytelling of his own personal life, sharing his bumps, bruises, bad choices, and along with some of the good things that have happened. And he transparently chronicles his journey in the hopes of helping others. You guys, please welcome my good friend, Mr. Terry Little. Terry, how are you, my dear?
I'm good. I am honored to be here. Now, you know, we've been rocking since 2016, so it's been a while.
I couldn't remember how long. I knew it had been a minute. Yeah, I couldn't remember. I didn't know how long,
yeah.
So thank you for that.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. So, yeah, I'm ready. Let's do it.
All right. So I think what I normally do with each guest is just to kind of open the floor, because I talk a lot in the beginning. But to open the floor to you and ask that you just kind of fill everybody in, let them know who you are, a little bit about your background, some of the things that you've been through, and it may or may not all be related to tonight's conversation. And as you know, like, it's just us chit-chatting. So just a really transparent conversation, just like it's just the two of us. So go ahead, if you wouldn't mind, Terry, and share who you are and kind of what you've been through.
Okay. Well, my name is Terry. That's my given government name. I hail from North Carolina, where I'm born and raised. I have a brother, and I have two girls of my own biologically, one son, and I have five grandchildren. So life is pretty busy. I've been through a lot of stuff in my life. You know, if you listen to my podcast, you know, I have a series on that podcast called The Origin, and it just tells my story from the beginning. And one of the stories that I tell is at the age of 16 or 15, I found out that the man that raised me was not my biological father. And the, how that changed the course of my life, because I was so upset, and a lot of things that I went through with that followed me throughout my life. Married to a wonderful woman. This is the third time around, so ain't gonna be no more. Let's see. We were raising three children together. Of course, my son, and then she has a son and a daughter. What else? I'm now residing in Columbia, Missouri, which is, me and her have made some great, we moved from North Carolina to Idaho. That's where we met, Marcy. I was living in Idaho at the time. And from Idaho to now, Missouri. So we've been across this great country, man. It's crazy out here. It really is. But I've been through a lot.
Y'all been on the move, honey. I can't keep up. They say I move a lot.
You do. You, man, you went from Arizona to Texas and back there. I was like, man, what is she doing?
Over in Salt Lake City. And I think you're about on par with me at this point with all the moves.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I really want to thank you, T. And for those of y'all, I call him T. Like, that's just kind of, I don't even know where that came from, but that's, so that's what I'm going to try and remember to say Terry, because that's what I'm supposed to say, but it's just us, we kicking it. So it's probably going to be T most of the time.
For sure.
So can you talk me through, because I, you know, like many people who are friends with you on social media, we saw what you show of the experience and finding out that your son got a diagnosis of autism. And can you talk about kind of how old he was and sort of what was going on that sort of led up to that, and maybe at what guided you towards getting how that diagnosis came about, I guess?
All right. So I'm going to try and not get choked up, because I normally do when I tell this story. So if I get quiet on you, that's what's going on. I have to gather my thoughts. So
no problem. No problem, my friend.
So how it started, you know, Terry Jr. was you know, born normally through C-section. He was hitting all of his milestones like he's supposed to. And at around 12 months, he started noticing that he was, like, kind of doing, you know, lining his cars together and just doing certain things at first. And so we really didn't think anything about it. What we did, we thought that he might have had fluid in his ears. So we go to the chiropractor. We get him adjusted to the fluid drains out. And that wasn't it, apparently. So at about 18 months, we took him to the specialist, or his specialist, and she said that he was on the spectrum, you know, autism, second level, whatever. He's nonverbal, and he has very huge developmental delays, right? So I remember sitting in the chair in the room with this specialist telling me and my wife that our son has autism. Now, to back it up a little bit, at 12 months, I took it to the doctor. Now, in no way am I saying that I blame vaccines or anything, but at the time, I did. Mm-hmm. So at 12 months, I took him to a 12-month checkup, and normally his mom would take him. And so I think she was working or doing something, and I got the responsibility of taking him. So I go, and by the end of the checkup, they say to me, or they ask me, well, Mr. Little, do you want him to have the MMR vaccines? And those of you who don't know what that is, it's mumps, measles, rubella. And I was like, I don't know, right? And so I let them give him the MMR vaccine. So after the vaccine, maybe two or three weeks later, maybe a month later, I was laying in the bed with my son. I was playing with him. I looked at him. And it's almost like you could see the light go out in his eyes. And he just stopped responding. And it was just like he stopped being playful. He shied away from everything. He was, you know, it was just, we just didn't know. And that's when we decided to get a take him to the specialist to get a diagnosis. And when we got that, my life changed in that moment, because that's something that we don't deal with in the African American community. We don't, because you didn't hear of autism when I was coming up, because I'm 47. I'm a man of a certain age, right? So, you know, we didn't never even know autism when coming up. Either, you know, excuse my wording here, but when we was coming up, it was slow and retarded or whatever. It was none of these scientific words they're using now, like autism spectrum disorder and all that. So for me, it was a stigma. I was like, okay, I don't know what this is. Where did this come from? What do I do now? All of that. And in that moment, I felt so hopeless. Like, my beautiful boy, God has blessed me and bestowed to me my first son. And for my son that he blessed me with to have this disorder, I was mad at God. I was mad at the doctor. I was mad at the vaccine. I was mad at myself. I mean, I just went through a gauntlet, you know. And so for many, many moons after that, I blamed myself. Like most parents do when something goes wrong with their kids, they blame themselves. It was, you know, it's my fault. I'm too old to be having kids anyway. You know, whatever. Any excuse that I used. And it was a struggle. It was tough. It was really, really tough. And to be honest with you, Marcy, it took me from his diagnosis to 2.5 years after that to even accept the fact that my son had autism. And it was just devastating. Now, my wife, she's a trooper. She's been through it before because her oldest son is a high functioning. And, you know, it was just, tough. I will watch her, and part of me will be mad at her because how are you not being affected by this? This is tearing me apart, right? And I didn't know what to make of it, right, until we moved to Missouri. And we left Idaho to move to Missouri because Missouri has more autism services, Easter Seals. The Thompson Center is here, one of the leading centers of autism in the country. You know, all of that. And we came here for a better opportunity for him. And I'm glad that he was diagnosed early. And so that just gives us, you know, more chance to help him out. But it was tough. I went through a gauntlet of issues with being pissed off and blaming the vaccine. Because for about a year there, Marcy, you couldn't tell me that the vaccine didn't cause my son's autism. You couldn't tell me. You couldn't convince me. Nobody could. It would have took God coming to my front door and telling me that it wasn't the vaccine for me to not to believe that it wasn't the vaccine, you know? And to the day, 5 years later, there are days that I struggle with it, you know? Because you know how Facebook is, right? Facebook is mm-hmm. full of those memories. I hate that.
Yeah.
And there are a couple of memories that when he had the use of words, he had about 6 or 7 words that he was using, and Facebook would throw those back. And I get to, you know, to watch my son take his first steps and use these words to him, like now, not having those words. It's hard still. And every time I see a video, I break down. I don't care where I'm at, if I'm at work, if I'm on the road, it doesn't really matter. It is just, to me, heartbreaking. But I've learned something, though. I've learned that even if there's, that's why they call them special needs, right? My son mm-hmm. is the strongest kid I know, and nothing stops him, even at 5. You know, this boy can work an iPad Pro better than I can. You know, and it's crazy how that works. But he is just the light of my life. And, you know, one of the lessons that a special needs nurse or a caregiver told me when we first started taking autism classes, because we had to learn how to deal with it. And I would always say, my autistic son, right? And she says, first of all, stop saying it like that. That's not how you say it. Your verbiage should be, my son who has autism. Autism doesn't make your son. Your son just has this disorder. That's it. He's still your son. I was like, oh, wow. Okay. And from that, led me down the road. Now I have to, you know, now I'm coming to grips. I still struggle. Not even though I still struggle, but I'm able to now understand. And, you know, deal with him accordingly. Teach him. He has a handheld communication device that he uses. You know, we make sure we use that. We use, you know, simple words, and he's getting it. He's grown by leaps and bounds since we left Idaho a couple years ago. So, yeah, it was tough. It was really, really hard, and it's still hard to the day.
So you're saying TJ had, he was using words and then stopped using words. Mm-hmm. Did I hear that correctly?
Yeah.
And so, because I've heard people say in the past too that vaccines, there's been a lot of discussion on different threads and things like that. About that. Now, again, for anybody who's listening, don't send no hate mail to me and don't send none to Terry.
Right, please.
That's not what we're saying, but this is all about how people come to terms with getting a diagnosis like this. Because to your point earlier, you said, you know, when we were coming up, nobody used clinical terms for anything. You know, even domestic violence, like it was just getting your ass whooped. Like it wasn't there was no words for it.
Right.
And so as you know, so I don't know if that's why we didn't hear about it, because people weren't using clinical terms, or if, because it just seems to me like so much now you see like kids that are on the spectrum, and it's like, where did this come from? And I've seen people have that discussion. So how did you get past, because you said like, I still struggle sometimes and I still question it sometimes, but what was the thing that kind of got you to say, okay, maybe it wasn't that?
But honestly, I still, I don't, my wife, if she's listening, she's, you know, but part of me still thinks that it was the MMR. And I think I would go to my grave believing that, or a small part of me would go to my grave, you know, believing that. Because it was so drastic of a change. Because, like I said, he had words, and he ate normally. There's a picture on my Facebook of him eating a T-bone steak, you know, when he was younger, right?
Mm-hmm.
But now he won't eat anything. I mean, it was just such a drastic change, you know? And that's why I blamed the vaccine, and to this day I still have that issue. But I don't think I've really snapped out of it. I think I still, in the back of my brain, in the bottom of my heart, I think I still believe it. But I've just had to kind of like push it down. Like you know, when you take out the trash, you know, you kind of push it down, and because you want to take the trash out. That's kind of like that,
mm-hmm.
because I didn't want to deal with it, so I just kind of pushed it down. But part of me still believes it. You know, not as much as
I wonder.
You know, I'm not an advocate, but
right. And so Melissa, you said Melissa's had experience with this with her older son. So how has that worked while you're trying to go through it? You said that was one of the struggles that y'all had, was like you're like falling out behind it basically, and she's, you know, kind of coping with it a little bit better. Like how did that kind of go? And if she wants to jump on, she's more than welcome to contribute to the conversation.
Yeah, I'm not sure she's listening. She's up in Illinois with her dad, so I'm not sure if she's listening. I sent him the link, though.
Oh, okay.
You know, our marriage has a very wacky dynamic, but it just works, right? Because there's a 14 year age difference between the two of us, so a lot of the child rearings and things of that nature, we do them differently. I'm from the old school, her not so much. You know what I mean? And when we had to deal with this, it was like, because it affected me so, I literally shut down. So I didn't say a lot. I didn't do a lot, you know, because I just couldn't. I was still in that fog of unbelief. Like, I can't believe God would give me my son and then give him autism. I just didn't believe that. But she was my backbone, though. She kept it all the way G with me. And she was like, you know, look, you're going to need to step out of this, because it is what it is. It's here. And the only thing that we could do is give him a better shot at life. And I was like, okay. You know, and eventually I snapped out of it. It didn't happen instantaneously. I mean, it wasn't like she said that and then I was, you know, here the next minute. No, it still took me about a year after to finally say, okay, all right, let's do this. Because at the end of the day, it's about him. And we make it work, and we're a team. And, you know, it's like we used to be, we would go out as a family. And because of he struggles with social cues, you know, and all that. And so what we do, he has a phone, and he normally is watching videos and stuff like that, right? So before, though, we couldn't really go out as a family because we didn't know how he was going to react, if he got overstimulated. So it's a lot of things we had to maneuver and fix and make plans for, like going to the grocery store, something as simple as that. We had to maneuver it and plan it because, you know, that's what this life has become for us. And, you know, it's a challenge. It's a challenge. It really is. You know,
yeah.
Finding caregivers.
I can only imagine.
Is what I mentioned.
I can only imagine. I remember when I was pregnant with my oldest daughter, and we have a caller. I think does Melissa's number start with 208?
Yeah.
Okay,
sure does.
I think that's her
That's
in queue. Okay, that's probably her in queue. I'm gonna bring you in just 1 second.
Okay.
But I remember when I was pregnant with my oldest daughter, and during the pregnancy, I had gotten they do these routine blood tests and whatever, and they're testing for all these different things. And so they had drawn blood, and they told me, well, we don't know if she either has, this is what they told me, she either has spina bifida or she has Down syndrome. And I was 20 at the time. Yeah, I was 20 at the time. I had just turned 20. And I remember thinking about all the things I wasn't ready for. Like, I wasn't even prepared to accept the idea of a diagnosis that something was, you know, not as it should be with my child. And, I mean, it was just, it was such a traumatizing experience. And so I can't even imagine, like, what y'all went through. Like, he's here. And I remember, like, you sharing the pictures when he was born. Like, he's such a beautiful little boy. And so vibrant with all of that. And so, like, the way you described it, like, you're looking at him and you're playing with him, and you said you could see the light go out in his eyes, and that just breaks my heart because no parent's ready for that. But let me bring Melissa in so she can she can kind of give her perspective. One second here. Hey, caller, is it you, Melissa?
Yes, it is.
Hey,
hey
thank
baby.
You so much for calling in.
Not a problem. How are you guys?
Good, good. I'm glad you called in. So you've been listening to the show, and so can you talk a little bit about, you know, I asked you a minute ago, how was that between y'all, since you kind of had a little bit of background with it, you've had some experience with it, and this is kind of his first go around. He said, like, she was my rock, she was my backbone, like she got me through it. But will you kind of share your perspective and, like, how you sort of felt when you found out that TJ got the diagnosis that he got?
Yeah, I think you can almost look at the responses in, like, a trauma form. You know, there's multiple different types of trauma responses, fight, flight, freeze. And I think, you know, Terry says I handled it so well. I think my reaction was just a little different. You know, I'm the full-time caregiver because Terry works full-time. I do a little bit out of the house, but he's the main provider for the family. So he works, I take care of the kids. And so upon diagnosis, we were already in a lot of services, speech, occupational therapy, you know, all these different types of things. And so life didn't stop just because my son had a label now. Did I struggle? Yes. And I struggled in different ways. But I couldn't stop going. I had to keep going. And now I was expected to do even more. Because once we got that diagnosis, then there were, you know, more doors open for different types of things. And so I think I fell into, you know, a type of trauma response where it was go, 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 you know, workaholic, get them in every program you can, just completely run myself down. Where Terry kind of shut down, I wore myself down, if that makes sense. So just we handled it, you know, both handled it hard, but differently. I also have, you know, an older child. They present very differently. You know, I have a nonverbal child. I have a very verbal child. So it's very different, and they all have their own challenges. And so for me, it was like, God, I already had enough to deal with, like, you know, not that my child was a burden, but how am I going to do this? I'm already in this that therapy, and now I'm adding that plus more. And we have to, you know, take care of the house and make sure, the other kids get to where they need to be in sports. And so, like I said, I was in the cycle of go, 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 go nonstop, and I just, and for 3-4 years, I put myself last to ensure that I needed, if that, you know, paints the picture.
No, it very much paints the picture, and I think that's a good analogy that y'all both handled it, and it was difficult for both of you, but the response was just different. And to your point, everybody does have different coping mechanisms when they are faced with a challenge or a trauma or anything like that, and so that makes perfect sense. And I think T said earlier, like, y'all's dynamic for your relationship in general is maybe a little bit non-traditional and things like that. And so I think that what you've described makes perfect sense. And you do, if one parent shuts down, you do have to have the other one that's kind of in high gear. So although that may not have been the best for you physically and emotionally, I get where that happens, and I get how that kind of rights the ship a little bit, even though it may not have been optimal. You know, like you said, like you're kind of run down, but yeah, it totally makes sense.
Well, and I think that, you know, to touch on like where his realization is coming in, you know, I think he's been included more, Terry, I think you could probably agree, you've been included more in some of the hands-on type of therapy stuff. And we started making it available so he could be part of it. You know, he was almost kind of removed from it because he went to work. By the time he got home at 7 p.m., everything was already done. Therapies were over. How do you accept and learn and grow when you're not touching it every single day, when you're not, you know, you're not in it? And so as we found ways to kind of insert Terry into maybe a therapy once a month or doing a review on his off day and sure, you know, only scheduling it on the day that he can attend so that way he can be part of it. I think as we went through this journey, we both kind of adjusted and grew together to kind of work through it. You know, not that we're ever going to be fully through it. He may never live on his own. We don't know, like, what the future holds. But I think we just learn and adjust. And we do just kind of fit very well where one falls, the other picks up, and vice versa in all areas of our relationship.
Yeah. See, do you feel like that helped a lot when you were able to be kind of brought into it and weren't kind of feeling, I don't know, did you feel like a bystander kind of, or did you not want to initially, or like how did you feel?
You know what? She is absolutely correct. I did feel like a bystander at first. But then on the flip side of that coin, though, I didn't really want to because I wasn't still accepting of his diagnosis. So I was like, I ain't going to no therapy for what? There ain't nothing wrong with him. You know what I'm saying? Going back to that stigma as a child, you know, as I was coming up. So when I started getting incorporated into therapies and peer reviews and things of that nature, the very first time was traumatic. When I tell you to sit there, I think I read a report that one of the therapists gave, and it was this whole book about what my son couldn't do and this and that. And that was kind of like my first taste of it. And not only did it, you know, it put me off, it made me very, very angry. Like, how dare this person, you know, tell me that my son can't do? But the reality came to be that at this juncture of the game, he can't. But I had to come to that realization. You know what I'm saying? And I tell you, and that
just because
to this
he
day
can't,
is still a struggle.
Just because he can't doesn't mean he won't. And I think that was huge. And that was something else that Terry had to. Except, you know, just because he can't now and just because he's delayed doesn't mean that he won't ever do it.
Oh, yeah.
And so if you continue to focus on what we can't do or what he can't do or the things that we can't go do as a family because of X, Y, and Z, then we'll never achieve them because we're not focusing on the things that we can do or that he can do. And so I think that was a big piece to it as well.
Yeah. That's it right there. Yeah.
Yeah, and I think, Melissa, I think you used the word because my son was labeled. And I think that in society in general, I think we all tend to buy into different labels. I mean, you think about when we talk about bullying or when we talk about even as adults, oh, she's a hoochie mama or he's a player or, you know, so-and-so thinks they know everything. You know, we begin to put in these boxes. And like you said, T, like when we came up, it was slow and we called, you know, there were other names, right? And so now we've learned, like, that's not conducive to anybody's good to, you know, just use derogatory terminologies and things like that. But when you know better, then hopefully you start to do better. And I think that's what we're seeing a little bit of. But there's one thing about those labels, and I do feel like regardless of what abilities he has now or doesn't have right now, I do feel really strongly that none of us should buy into people's labels. And there's so much comparison of people in general that when you start trying to give somebody a label and then we base the expectations on the label instead of basing them on the individual. And like you said, like he has a communication device right now, so he's learning how to move in a different way and communicate in a different way. You know, we do a lot of diversity training and, you know, obviously people that are differently abled and things like that, that's part of, you know, accepting diversity and what everybody brings to the table. And so let's talk a little bit about, Terry, you said TJ's taught you a lot and you learned a lot from him. Let's talk about some of that because I want people to understand that I was just talking about this with my business partner yesterday or the day before. Not even saying I'm different. I'm me. Like, he's just TJ. He's not different. He's not what, like, even different is a label, right? And so let's talk about some of the things that you guys have maybe learned from him that he's helped you kind of grow through.
Maybe you want to start that one?
Yeah. He is such a learner. He is so smart. And he will not stop. If he needs something or wants something, he will go to all extremes to get his needs met. So his persistence. And it's just a reminder that, like, life gets really hard and challenging, but he never gives up. You know, he just looks at it differently and he tries again. And I think that's something that we can all learn, is to, like, take little bites, you know, and chew what you can and then just keep going. Don't give up. That's the biggest thing I want to say. But, like, love needs the words. That's another big one that I say that he's taught me. We can have a whole conversation and never utter a word. You know, he communicates if you are willing to open your eyes and slow down enough to communicate with him, right? And so love needs no words. It's action and in truth, you know. We can say all we want, but do our actions align with the words that come out of our mouth? And these are just all, like, very simple life lessons, but he's a reminder of them every day.
Yeah.
I love that love needs no words.
Oh, yeah. And that was one of the things that I learned, too, get to piggyback off what my wife says, that he taught me how to slow down, right? Because in order for me to help him, I had to slow myself down. I was doing so much. I was everywhere, emotionally, mentally. I was kind of everywhere. And one of the lessons that I had to do was to slow down and just to stop. And he taught me that. And I got to become a better man because of it. Because, you know, I was able to slow down and do things a little bit different, make some better choices, still jack up every now and then, but I try to make some good choices. And he did, and the big thing, like Melissa said, is the love needs no words. Like I say, we can have a whole convo and he won't utter a word. Which I think is awesome. So I've learned that.
What were some of the things that you guys found helpful to be able to kind of get to the place where you are now with it, where you have learned to slow down and, you know, where I know Melissa mentioned that there were some programs and things that you guys signed up for, and there's additional resources where you live now. So talk about some of that kind of stuff. Like, how did you even go about finding that stuff?
Oh, man, I'll tell you something. My wife is a complete, she's a hound. When I tell you, she's like a dog with a bone. If she starts something, she's not going to sleep until it's done, right? And so once we got the diagnosis, like she said earlier, we had speech therapists and we had occupational therapists, great ladies. We still keep in contact with them back in Idaho. But she just kept going. She just gnawing at the bit. We can get this. We can get this course, this therapy, this thing, that thing. I mean, she has her hands, and she's like an octopus. She has so much stuff going and has her hands everywhere. But she is absolutely relentless when it comes to it. When it comes, she's truly in mama bear form when it comes to him. And she's going to search to the ends of the earth for every therapy, for every outlet that we can use to help him and give him a better, set him up for a better life. She's going to do that. So, yeah. That's the hound dog over there, babe.
I can touch on that a little bit more in like technical terms and more of an educational sense. But I think that key is education. You know, when you start to see that there may be something that you need to be willing to open your eyes and your heart to, you can't just like hear it and then do nothing, right? Like you have to learn about it. Just like you want to ride a bike, you learn about the bike, how to air up the tires, where the brakes are at. You know, you have to learn about autism and you have to learn about the expressive and receptive language disorder that comes along with it. And you have to learn about, you know, different things like maybe a child being overstimulated or understimulated. Until you can understand your child, you're not fully helping them. So you have to be able to be willing to, you know, really indulge yourself to learn about it, to be able to understand, to help guide and help your child through that learning process. So honestly, I'm a very resourceful person. We have everything we need at our fingertips. And I just started researching different types of therapies, what they're used for, how do you get them? Where does the funding come from? Because a lot of people don't realize just because you live in Missouri doesn't mean you're going to get the same services that I get in one county versus another. A lot of people think it's statewide, but it's really countywide. Where's the money at? Where are these programs at? And so people move around thinking, oh, someone said there's a good place here, but not knowing that if you live just 5 minutes over that line somewhere else, you don't get the same services I get. So when you look for services and when you look for housing and, you know, there's so many different things that go into it. Like, you're not just finding any apartment that's open. You have to find somewhere where you know that you can get your child some help. So really just researching, being willing to learn about the education, and then community. That's the second biggest thing, I think, is you cannot isolate because you cannot do this alone. And you shouldn't do it alone, and your child shouldn't do it alone. You have to throw yourself out there. I was one of the most introverted people around, and I'm like advocating in the Capitol now, like grassroots lobbying, and I don't know what's going on in my life, right? But I was like the biggest introvert. But I had to learn how to throw myself out there and build connections, because the connections is where I also learn about more services. It's where I got support. Where I learned that I could get an advocate to come with me to an IEP meeting because I don't know all the laws, you know, and sometimes school districts don't always do what they're supposed to. And sometimes your child isn't given the services that they need, and you have to know the laws. You have to be educated on the laws and what your child is legally has rights to ensure that your child is getting the best services and, you know, the individualized services that your child needs. You know, just because one child has autism doesn't mean they all need the same thing. And so, you know, a lot of that research goes into, again, education and community, throwing yourself out there, getting connected with people, groups, places, being willing. You have to be willing.
And so being part of that community and finding other parents and you know, people who are knowledgeable about these things, does that help you not only with the educational pieces of it and stuff like that, but is it, I would imagine you can kind of compare notes. And I mean, every child is different, but I also think that, or maybe it's just my belief, that there's a lot of new, every day something new is coming up and becoming available, and new treatments and new methodologies and things. Is that some of the things that you find that you get from that sense of community?
Oh, absolutely. You know, one parent might go through with their child might be completely different from the next, but somebody in the group is going to resonate with your story somewhere. And somebody has information, and that's what I mean by, like, community, because somewhere, no matter what you're going through, whether it be a school issue, a medical issue, maybe a specific, you know, diagnosis in addition to autism, because just because you have autism doesn't mean you don't have any other conditions. I have a cousin and that has autism along with Marfan's and Williams syndrome, so he has all sorts of different challenges that him and his family face, and so you just never know what piece you might get. And so, you know, I've learned so much from that. And then what else I've learned is then how to help advocate and support other people through it as well. So it's a big, you know, support group for everybody. And we just kind of love on one another, right? Like, you need help. Okay, we all help each other. We all love on each other. If I can't do it, then maybe she can do it. And we've kind of just got this hands-on approach to where we all support one another, because at the end of the day, it's about the children. Doesn't matter my political view. It doesn't matter your political view. It doesn't matter, you know, that your kid's 3 years older than mine. Whatever the case may be, at the end of the day, it's about the children getting what they need and helping them, you know, progress in their future. And so I love it. I love being connected to a community of people, you know, that are willing to support and engage that way.
What did you guys find when you found out about the diagnosis? How did that affect, because I know it affects your relationship and you all have to make adjustments there, but going outside of that to close associates, friends, other family members, what was that experience like? How did you guys feel about that? T, I'm going to throw that out to you first.
Okay. Well, I don't have a lot of family out here, so they don't get to experience it. You know, all my family is back east. I went home last back in 2018 with Terry Jr. and the family, and everybody handled it okay. It's like he turned a year old when we went the first time, and everybody wanted to handle him like crystal. You know, like when you buy a fine crystal vase, you don't want to really hold it because you're afraid to break it.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of how they treated Terry. But I don't have a lot of family that deals with it on a daily or even a monthly basis, for that matter. So I really can't attest to the family part of it. I don't have a lot of friends other than my social media buddies, and they're not here. So the ones that have interacted with Terry Jr., they love him, you know. And I got one social media friend that I don't care if I'm having a FaceTime conversation with him or whatever. If Terry gets into the camera, he's going to wave at him. Like he'll wave at nobody else, but he waves at him. And I was like, what? Why him? And so it's just, but I don't have a lot of interaction with him. It's just me and him and Melissa and the family for me. Now, she can attest to her side of it, but for me, that's what it is.
Well, before we get Melissa's side, I want to find out, how did it make you feel you said the family treated him like he was, like, you know, made of glass or something, or he was somehow breakable.
Yes.
How did that make you feel, and did that affect? Do you feel like that affects your relationship with your family?
That's a good question. No, I don't know. And the reason why, I think when we went home in 2018 and that happened, it was just like, well, they don't know. You know, my family, mm-hmm. we're all old school. We're from the country, you know. So the mentality has always been, oh, you know, he's so special, you know, and they don't really understand. And so I don't really mm-hmm. blame them. Now, if I was there full time, you know, and they was doing that all the time, then it'd be a conversation. But being mm-hmm. that it was the first time meeting Carrie, I didn't really expect anything more than what they did, you know, because I know my family, you know, so.
Right.
But did it change anything with them? Nah, because they don't really understand. They love me, and so they understand for me, if that makes
right.
sense. Well,
yeah,
I understand, Terry, because I love you, you know. But that's kind of what it was. No, nothing against family. I love them. They love me. They love Terry. They don't see him. I mean, the last time they saw him, he was a year old. He's five now.
Right. So. What about you, Melissa? How did that – do you feel like it affected friend relationships or extended family or anything like that?
I think it's an ongoing challenge because you always have to educate people. And if you – how do I say this? You can do it the wrong way and leave a lasting impression that doesn't ever educate anybody about autism, if that makes sense, if you do it wrong. And so and it's not the same with everybody. And so it's really a hard water to navigate. But yes, absolutely. I think it makes relationships hard, especially when, you know, you don't have a lot of support or there aren't a lot of people that can help step in and care for somebody, say, like, I'm in Chicago caring for my father who's sick, you know, and it's hard because we don't have a whole lot of support. We don't have a whole lot of people that can step in and just jump in and handle that role because he does have quite a bit of additional needs and his communication is very different than a neurotypical child. So definitely, and like I said, educating, you know, how I educate my mom compared to my dad or my brother looks very different. And sometimes you have to repeat it a few times and, you know, there's been times where conversations got ugly and I, you know, chose to just remove myself from different areas because a lot of the older generation is just, you know, they'll pull you up by the bootstrap, beat them, whoop them into shape, they'll be all right.
right.
And I think we all know by now that's not the case. You could whoop a child that has an autism diagnosis. They're going to look at you, laugh at you, and do the same thing over again. So it's not about they didn't get a hard enough, you know, butt whooping. So I think a lot of people go through that, and it's really, really hard when you're, you know, really close with your family, and there's a divide in that sense of, you know, understanding where they're not even willing to see differently, if that makes sense. Like, they're not willing to even see it in a different light. But I think as I explain more and I educate more and I don't allow, you know, I don't just be quiet and say nothing. I educate and I say, well, no, this is happening because of this. So this is why we do X, Y, Z. So this may seem completely off the wall to you and like I'm some insane parent, but once you connect these dots, you're like, oh, okay, this makes sense, you know.
Right.
Life looks very different for us. Life looks very different.
So when you say life looks different for us, I know Terry mentioned at the beginning we were talking about like just a simple trip to the mall or to the grocery store or like y'all just have to prepare differently. Can you share some examples of what those, like how that process is and sort of where you find, like how did you figure out, like, I, you know, like you said, I have to, you know, just learn my child. but what's that process like? Because I think sometimes people see children in the store that have learning struggles or challenges, or they maybe they do have autism or whatever, and the assumption based on how they're acting is, oh, they, like you said, like, oh, they need a spanking. Well, no, that's not gonna be the thing. That's not the answer. So how did y'all figure that out? And what do you do? How does that work?
Trial and error. That's how we figured it out. Trial and error. I mean, because, you know, we could not go out. We had to figure that out. Melissa is kind of the stickler. She's just, okay, honey, we got to do it this way. We got to take Terry Jr. and we have to make sure he has this and make sure he has this in order for us to do this. He's going to be, you know, he'll stay calm for this amount of time, you know, with this. So she's figured it out and I just follow suit. You know, I'm not much of a thinker. That's my wife's job. So she thinks for me, you know. Love you, honey.
It really boils down to strategy. You know, is it a quick trip? Is there going to be cell service?
Yeah.
Can he be satisfied on the cell phone for, you know, 15 minutes, 20 minutes while we shop with his favorite show? If he doesn't have a phone, phone's dead, or he's really crabby, maybe we choose to go without whatever we needed and get him home and settled, and I wait till my husband gets home, and then we go to the store. I think as all any parent of any child, you know, we shift and adjust to, like, the child's mood.
Yeah.
But with Terry, I think you have to go a little, you know, additional step. You know, he's got really heightened sensory chews, so he has different devices that we bring that he can chew on. You know, if it's hot or cold, does he have socks and shoes in the car? Because he also has pica, and he eats the strings out of his socks, and what goes in must come out, you know. They don't have, you know, handicap dolls everywhere for kids. You know, they have these little plastic changing tables. Well, your child's 5 and 6 and 7 and up, and you're still in a diaper. We have to make sure where we're going, we're able to change our kid. How long are we going to be gone? Where are we going to have to change them? You know, so there's so many different areas of how life looks different, not in just preparing to go to these places. And, you know, making sure we're pretty precise on time and having the items. But, like, are we able to even go to these places? Can these places service us, and are they inclusive?
Right.
How do you, is there a way that you can kind of tell some of that in advance? Do you, like, call ahead? Or is it kind of like Terry said, like, it's just you try it and...
So I got connected with... some lovely ladies who started this grassroots lobbying, and they've really worked on changing laws for children that have additional needs like autism, but not just autism, like all diagnoses, because lots of kids could benefit from early intervention. And they got this bathroom app created and designed where you can pull up the app. It's called Restroom App. It has wheelchair and this mint green like location dot on it, and you can download that app and you can search for bathrooms in the area that are full service, like handicap, where you could lay an adult down on a changing table and change them if you needed to. That is ever evolving and growing, and so that's one way for, like, bathrooms for people that have larger changing needs. But other things is really, like Terry said, by experience. Like, we can try something. We did bowling, and he did okay for, like, 10 minutes, and then it was not a fun experience because all I did was rip and run and try to keep him safe, and he just kind of freaked out. And so it was best to just, like, cancel the bowling and just go, you know?
Right.
So a lot of it is trial and error and see if he likes it. He really likes roller skating. We never knew that would be a thing, but we tried.
Me neither.
He loves trampolines, and he'll jump on trampolines at home, but if you take him to a trampoline park, he doesn't do well there, you know? And so, like I said, a lot of that is just trial and error. Can we do it? If not, then we know. We all look at each other, and we pack up, and we leave. You know, it's like a mutual family thing.
Yeah.
How have your other children adapted?
My oldest has his struggles of his own, and that's like a whole different topic. He has autism, but he also has a lot of different other mental health diagnoses that make it even more challenging. And so it's really hard with those two because the oldest, when he gets overstimulated, he can't or won't stop being like super rough with the youngest. And so that can be really challenging. And then we have my daughter who's kind of sandwiched in between both boys with, you know, additional needs. And she's kind of had to take on the role of like second mom. She's my right-hand man. We go out. She knows what needs to be done, how we do it, you know, where things are. I mean, she could literally step in and tell an adult what to do and how to do it. She's like my little mini-me. And so that's been hard on her to have to be so responsible at, you know, a young age. But it's something that, you know, you have to work together as a family. So it's just, I think, part of our family dynamic.
What advice can y'all give to someone that feels like something's off, or maybe they see a shift in their child? Because I know one of the things that we like to, in general, do is, oh, well, they'll outgrow it, or, oh, it's just a phase, or how do you, what would you tell them if they're sensing something?
Well, if it was me, don't ignore it. That's the first thing that I would say, is don't ignore it. If you feel that your child is not growing or progressing like they're supposed to, get them checked. They can be screened for autism now. And don't be afraid of what comes out of that doctor's mouth. And that's one of the things that I had to learn, because I was so afraid and scared and confused and everything else when Terry got his diagnosis. One of the things I can say is don't be afraid. I mean, it's every life. You learn about everything in life, and this is another thing you have to learn. You know, you have to learn to adapt. But if your child is, you know, get them screened. Don't be afraid of it. You know, don't say, oh, he'll grow out of it. Like you said, he'll grow out of it. No, go get him screened. Because I almost said that to my wife.
It's not the end. It's the beginning. It's the beginning of something so beautiful. Because there's something so beautiful in watching your child grow through their struggles and being able to be their support system through that and to be able to love on and cheer them. I mean, when he says a word, like, y'all, he waved, and that's an everyday thing.
Mm-hmm.
But, okay, the boy waved. Do you know how many years we've been waiting for him to wave at us again? That's a big thing. So we get to celebrate, like most people celebrate, what, birthday, Christmas, Easter, right? Like we get to celebrate with our child so much. And we are just really thankful for the small things in life. And so a diagnosis is not the end, it's the beginning. And you waiting because not wanting to accept something might be wrong could be the year or two that decides whether or not your child ever learns to read or talk or what have you. You know, early intervention is absolutely key. Absolutely key.
Absolutely.
And if they don't have it, it's okay to get your child speech therapy if they're struggling with language. Like, it's okay.
Mm-hmm.
Your child can still have a language delay and not have autism, or, you know, your child may struggle with gross motor skills and maybe they need some occupational therapy. They don't have to have a diagnosis to be able to need a little bit more help to learn and grow efficiently for them. And so I would just say we owe it to our children to get them assessed, and best case scenario, there's nothing there and they don't need any help, and you know that you did the right thing by checking. So it doesn't hurt to, but, you know, and if you don't agree, it doesn't hurt to get a second opinion either. And that's in any sort of medical or therapeutic sense. You know, if you're not vibing with something, then try something different.
Yeah, I'm all about that. I mean, I think you said it earlier about the advocacy piece. And I think whether it's for ourselves or for our children, I feel like now probably more so than ever, because I feel like practitioners are very, very quick to medicate and are more eager to medicate and treat symptoms than to actually find out what the source is and be able to come up with a treatment plan that doesn't include drugs or medication. But if you don't advocate for yourself and you don't advocate for your kids, they're real quick to write a prescription and come back in 90 days. Like, no, it's not what we need.
Well, and I think we need to question things. Just because you're a physician doesn't mean, you know, I grew up and I was very naive. Maybe it was the way I was raised. Maybe it was just the time I was raised in. But we looked at, like, attorneys and doctors and all these people, like, I don't know, like, feel like we put them on a pedestal and what they said went. And I'm sorry, but I counter a lot of doctors and we have a lot of good dialect and conversations, and a lot of times things change and eyes are open and things spark. And so I think it's okay to question things, and, you know, you have to be that. You are your child's only voice, and only you know what's best. So don't ever, I think another big thing I always tell families is don't let them make you think you're crazy. Like, if you think that you're crazy because you think something is wrong with your child and you know for a fact and everyone's telling you you're not, 9 times out of 10, you're right. Right? Like, what's that disease called when you make stuff up? Is it Munchausen's or something like that?
Mm-hmm.
You know, like, how many people...
Oh, yeah, when you make stuff up to get attention.
Right. So, like, what's the chances that, like, all of us just think our kid's wrong? You know that we all have Munchausen. Like, no. We know when there's something not sitting right in our spirit about our child. And so don't ever let somebody tell you that that's not right. I've had that feeling multiple times in multiple different scenarios with my children and their services. And you have to have that, like, tough skin to be able to say, well, doc, I don't agree, you know, and be willing to advocate. And then if you're not sure, ping that off other people as well. You know, other people in the field, other professionals that you feel comfortable with. You know, like I said earlier, education and community. I always go back to those two things.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think that really speaks to the benefit that building up that community and, you know, availing yourself of, you know, you don't have to be a doctor to have experience in something. And I think sometimes we put a little bit too much emphasis on a medical degree versus somebody who's got some lived experience. And, you know, it's one thing to know what the textbooks tell you and to know, you know, standard courses of treatment and things like that. But really, when you've got a community of people that are boots on the ground that are dealing with us on a day-to-day basis in varying degrees, I think that's maybe as beneficial, if not more beneficial in some ways, than just a physician's opinion.
Oh, absolutely. And even when, like, you know, if you look at it on a quick political side, you know, in order to get things changed when things aren't right, like, we have to be willing to work together to get those changes made. Because the people that don't deal with these things, the people that don't have to go to all these therapies and to, you know, rearrange their lives and live a completely different life, they don't realize that changes need to be made and they're not going to get done. And so, you know, we're so wrapped up and we're so busy already with our own lives that we just get so sucked into our own world that we don't see that, like, our story can help make a difference in other places. And that's kind of how our advocating took a turn, and that's how I'm in the, you know, I hate politics. I really do. I've always said, like, I hate politics. I'm never getting super involved with that. And, like, tell God your plans and watch him laugh at you. He'll put you right in there, you know, and because because our kids need help, because our kids deserve more, because our kids, you know, should be included in education and in different things. We have to fight for that. So being willing to, you know, put yourself out there and do those types of things as well is really vital.
Well, and it's like I was telling a friend of mine, I always tease him and I tell him, I'm like, you're a unicorn. I'm like, stop, you can't be a unicorn and think like a horse. So you're trying to look at what other people may do, need, think, et cetera, through your gaze. And it's like, you don't think like, if you're a unicorn, you don't think like a horse. And so you have to bring in some horses to understand what horses need. And so I think that this is that type of thing where sometimes, you know, we may be in a position to do, to provide some resources or create solutions or maybe change some laws and stuff. But if you've never been in that, if you're not a horse and you're a unicorn, you can't possibly know. Like you use the example of the changing table, right?
Yep.
I would have never in 1,100 million years have ever thought of something like that.
Right.
You know what I mean? Like you just, what does somebody do in that instance? And I think that when we've got people that are making these laws and writing these, the American Disabilities Act or whatever, ADA, when they're adjusting and making modifications to that, do you have people who are contributing information like that? You know, how many years did it take us to say, oh, we should have ramps on buildings instead of stairs? I mean, that's
right.
And I think it's because we have unicorns trying to make rules for horses, and the horses are like, yeah, that doesn't help me.
Well, and, you know, let's think about it for a second here. The Americans with Disability Act was signed into law in 1990. Like, it wasn't that long ago that we even started treating people with disabilities like human beings.
Right.
So
that's what I'm saying. Like, it took, I didn't know when, but I knew that it was within my lifetime because I remember I was a banker at the time. I was a bank executive, and we had to redo some of our branches to make them accessible. Like, we had to put in lower counters for people who are in wheelchairs. We had to build ramps. We had to make sure, you know, the amount of space between the doors was adequate, like all kinds of stuff. And that is only touching the surface because I could tell you right now that in any one of my branches that you would not be able to change your son probably in at least 50% of them at the time. I mean, I may have changed now, but you see what I'm saying? Like, and like you said, that's 1990.
Yep. Yeah,
our lifetime.
Yeah, you know, and the big thing right now that's getting looked at with our children is seclusion and restraints, and you could have a whole show about that. But it's a law that the ladies that I'm working with this year got passed last year, and it actually goes into effect this year. So you have all these schools who've been locking kids in rooms and using them incorrectly, using them as forms of discipline, you know, restraining people. You know, we watched a gentleman get killed on the street being restrained, and these restraints are happening to our children in our schools, to children with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And people don't even realize that this stuff is happening in their backyards.
Yeah, and that was one of the reasons, you know, I shared with Terry when I reached out to him and I asked him, I said, would you consider having a conversation about this? Would you feel comfortable talking about it? Just because I just feel like a lot of times, and he said, you know, he doesn't talk about it a lot. And I feel like if we don't that was one of the things with this podcast is being able to have a platform where we can talk about some of the stuff that we kind of tuck away and nobody wants to shed light on. But there are families that are going through this. There are individuals who are going through any number of different things and different experiences. And I feel like one of the best things that I can do as a conduit is to be able to open up some of these dialogues and help people to understand. And in order to do that, you have to have people like you guys who are willing to have some of these conversations and be able to be forgiving if you know, somebody like me, who that's not my lived experience. So I might use the wrong words sometimes. And like you said, Melissa, like being willing to educate people. And sometimes you have to tell people more than once. But if we're not even opening up a conversation about it, and, you know, for me, Terry, for you, it was important because, like you said earlier, especially in the African-American community, we want to keep everything inside the house a lot of times. And we're doing everyone in the community and at large a disservice if we refuse to have conversations because they're uncomfortable. Who can grow through it? You can't heal what you can't speak on.
Well, and I think that, you know, and it's hard for me to even speak on it because I'm not African American, but my kids are, and I can see it, and I can see the struggle. And I have many friends that are African American, but I think it's bigger than just, like, not being willing to talk about it because there's a lot of fear there. There's fear that, mm-hmm. that they're going to be told they're not capable to take care of their child, or fear that the people are going to come and take their kid, or so that there's so many fears that hold families back, the African American community back from getting help or trying to get these services, and then, you know, trying to fit this mold of what this, you know, black mom is supposed to do and look like. It's really challenging. I mean, I'm white and I struggle with just trying to be what I'm supposed to be, but then you add in all those other factors that I don't deal with, and I can't imagine those things. You know, mm-hmm. it's hard enough for me to find those services, and I do have, you know, some advantages, and that's reality. It's reality that it's hard, and it's hard to be an ally that wants to help bridge that gap, but I've told mm-hmm. Terry and I talk about this all the time. I just don't know. I don't know how, and I know that I just continue to ask God to help, you know, mend and build and guide that, because I think that we would see so many different changes and so much growth in all areas with so many different people if they felt more supported and there wasn't that fear of trying to go get that help. That should be so simple. If I just need a referral to go see if my child's delayed, you know, like that shouldn't have to be so scary for somebody, but it is.
Yeah, you bring up a really valid point about that, and that was something like I hadn't even thought of, the fear of being deemed incapable of taking care of your child, or you know, just judgment in general, and because there is so much misunderstandings about what the cause of, you know, different delays are and things like that, and so many false accusations can be made and, you know, all kinds of stuff. And I hadn't even thought about that. And so that's the kind of stuff I mean when I say being willing to have these conversations. And for you, you know, as an ally, the best thing you can do is be supportive and offer information when you have it. And to, you know, for you to call in tonight, like, I think that's wonderful. I'm so glad that you did. I think you brought so much information to the show that people are, you know, that was the whole goal, is for people to be able to get an understanding of something that maybe they're not familiar with, but then if it happens in their family or it happens with their grandchildren or something like that, to be able to say, you know what, I remember, like, I was listening to this show and this lady said, you know, that there's resources out there. Like, they don't have to remember my name. They don't have to remember your name. Nothing, but just the fact that we were able to have the conversation. And that's what I'm so grateful to you both for your willingness to be transparent. And for, you know, T, I know that was one of the things you said at the beginning. You're like, if I get choked up because, you know, I still get emotional about this. And I think even for that, being able to be transparent about that And as a man, as a father, as a husband, to be able to say, you know what, when this happened, I shut down. Like my wife, she picked up the pieces. She was the one who, you know, really dug her feet in and made sure things kept going. And I think that those transparent conversations help people more than you know, because a lot of, you know, we're looking at suicides and we're looking at things that our kids are going through and the number of youth who are committing suicide. And I think everybody's just in a really, really tough place for a lot of different reasons. And everybody's going through something. And like I said, y'all's willingness to have this very, very transparent conversation, I believe, is going to help somebody. So what are some final thoughts that y'all have?
My final thought is this. Again, Marcy, thank you for having me on. It was an honor to be here. I've had you on my show back when I was doing the Common Sense Show TV years ago. Seems like years ago anyway. My thing is, for the parents that are listening to this that may have the idea that children or their child is going through a struggle, like I said before, earlier, please do not ignore it. And if they do come out to get a diagnosis, just know that it's not a diagnosis of anything negative. It is that they'll love you in a different way. Like Melissa said, alluded to earlier, we just have to see things a little different and love on them regardless. That's my final thought.
Well, so what about you? What final thoughts do you have?
I just want to thank you for giving me the opportunity to jump on and you know, kind of help share some of my experience through your platform, because it's really what I do. You know, that's kind of my whole life now. I just I love on people. I love on people until they can love on themselves. And I think that's what I would leave people with, is if you do everything out of love, everything else falls into place. If you know somebody that's, you know, struggling with a diagnosis or, you know, their child going through some things, just times may be really hard for them and they may try to withdraw, but love them anyways and love them through it and don't let them, you know. So that's what I got.
No, I think a lot of us could. I think what you said earlier, and I wrote it down, love needs no words, and that's an action that we can all do. And I think, I said at the beginning of the show, I, you know, sent prayers out to the families in Uvalde, Texas. Everybody needs love right now. I know there's a lot of despair and a lot of sadness with today's news, and this is hard for everybody when crimes are committed against children. That's always, it's hard anyway when there's mass shootings, but when children are involved, it's especially hard. And so I think that we could all do a little bit more loving on each other, a little less talking sometimes, a little less judgment, and really opening ourselves up to acceptance and kind of moving forward from there. Is there any way, if people wanted to reach out to you, Melissa, and I'm going to get to you in a minute about the podcast, because you're an advocate and you're doing some really great work, I do want to probably have you on independently on some other stuff about how you became an advocate like that. But is there somewhere that, like, do you have a way for people to reach out to you if they have questions or anything like that?
I have a public profile on Facebook. And so anybody can find me on Facebook and shoot me a message. I help people all day, every day. People all over across the country. If I don't know the answer, I'll go to my people that maybe have a little bit more experience and try to help find answers or responses. I've helped given out letters that maybe people need to send to schools or walk through, you know, their rights and IEPs. And if I can do it, you know, I will do it. And so just reach out to me. I'm Melissa Little on Facebook. I'd be happy to help anybody that could use a little guidance.
Perfect. Thank you for that. And then, T, real quick, before we got about 4 minutes left, talk about how people can find you and talk real quick. Give me a 2 minute on Knucklehead Chronicles, because I really wanted to get into that more, but I felt like this conversation really was really serving people. So tell us about that.
Okay. So my podcast, the Knucklehead Chronicles podcast, is in two different forms. I have my personal podcast that I do by myself, and then I have the Knucklehead Chronicles, the panel edition, that we do live on Sundays on Facebook. We're actually on Roku TV with BS3 TV network. But my podcast can be heard everywhere where podcasts can be heard, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts. My story is just simply telling mine and hoping that someone can listen to it and let it resonate with them and say, oh, you know what? I did the same thing he did, but he did it a different way, you know? So that's about it. I mean, I'm really simple. I just want to help people. If I don't touch everybody, as long as I can touch somebody, I'm good, right? I just want to tell people about my story and how I overcame and how I met the lady in my life and my backbone and how I came from rags to riches almost, you know. But doing my podcast is really, really fun because it really opens up. Even telling my story over again is helping me all over again. So it's pretty awesome. So check me out across all podcasts and platforms.
And that's Knucklehead Chronicles podcast. And you said it's on all the platforms. Okay, perfect. So, guys, that's it for us tonight here on V2V Podcast. I want to thank Terry Little and Melissa Little. Melissa joined in to kind of, I think, lend some support and definitely dropped a whole lot of gems of nuggets and knowledge. So if you missed any of the show, I encourage you to go back, listen to the replays, because she really, really shared some great information, and I feel even more inspired by you both for all of the work that you're doing and just the positive attitudes, and it just glows outward from both of you. So thank you both for joining me. For those of you who are listening, I know I say it every week, but every week it rings true. And I am abundantly grateful for the opportunity to be in relation with amazing individuals who, like my guests tonight, are committed to uplifting and healing of other people. I think we heard from Melissa when she talked about community that it does take a village. And I'm always grateful that my village is continuing to grow and to prosper and to blossom. So if you have any story ideas, if you've missed any episodes, go to 9seconds.org/V2V as in Voiceless to Victorious. And that's the number 2 V. There's also an online forum if you want to be a guest, share some thoughts or ideas. So Terry, Melissa, thank you so much. Have a wonderful night. And for you guys listening in the meantime and in between times, we will see you back here next Tuesday. So stay healthy, stay safe, stay successful. And like we said, like Melissa said, love needs no words. So just love on your neighbors. I think everybody could use a hug tonight. Have a good one, you guys.